everybody, and welcome to the 75th episode of the epic Vassals of Kingsgrave linear Song of Ice and Fire reread. My name is Bina 007, and I'll be your host today, and I am joined by Enigmas.
Hi, Enigmas on the forums, Ty, in real life.
Great to podcast with you for the first time. I'm also joined by my girl, Hannah.
Hey, it's Shadow Baby on the forums.
Oh, you sound so hungover and ill. I love it. I love it.
That's commitment.
That is commitment.
I may or may not be guilty as charged.
That's okay, girl. I'll be your lawyer. I'll be your friend in court. We're also joined by the wonderful Xander.
Hello, Lord Baron on the phone. Xander in real life.
And by David, stepping in for It Rhymes with Sleekers, Emergency Peanut.
David HHH on the forums.
Ah, such a great crow. Right, so the last episode we ended with Tyrion pondering the birth of kings. This episode we're going to cover Dany 4 from Dance, Cersei 5, and Jaime 3 from Feast for Crows. The events take place from March 21st to March 23rd, but they start on March 23rd. We have Jaime 3, which evidently takes place over a number of days. So, it just remains to be said that we will potentially spoil anything from A Song of Ice and Fire. I don't envisage us doing any TWOW spoilers this episode, but if we do, they'll be clearly marked up so you can avoid them if you want to. We won't be spoiling the show, and of course, all opinions are our own. So, let's jump into Dany 4. This takes place on March 21st, 300 AL. It's 10 chapters and 150 pages after the previous Tyrion chapter. So, kind of interesting that even in Feast Dance, when we start to combine, Dany's chapters always feel just wildly kind of out of sync and out of place from everybody else's. And it's a tie with the chapter summary. Over to you.
Yes. All right. So we open on Daenerys welcoming Galadza Galor, also known as the Green Grace, to the Great Pyramid in Meereen. As the old woman and young dragon queen get to talking, we learn that the Karthine have embargoed the bay, and Karth and new Gis are making moves to close the river to Meereen as well. Even more problems crop up for Dany as the conversation moves to focus on the enemies within the city of Meereen. The Sons of the Harpy have been murdering her freedmen. The Green Grace wonders why hostages that Dany has taken are still unharmed. Dany can't bring herself to slay innocence, which, while admirable, isn't helping the situation and makes her appear somewhat craven to some. The old woman urges Dany to wed his Dar Zoloric as he is descended from a great lineage. Eventually, she sends for his Dar and dismisses the Green Grace, and the two get to talking. When asked about the Sons of the Harpy, Hisdar denies any knowledge about who controls the group, and as torture is mentioned in passing as a way to get people to talk, Hisdar claims that torture isn't useful as a means of gathering true information. Dany has him kiss her and, quote, feels no stirrings. Dany basically isn't into him. When Dany talks of plans to return to Westeros, Hisdar says he prefers to take each day as it comes. He doesn't share her ambition. Finally, Dany tentatively promises to marry Hisdar if he can stop the Sons of the Harpy for 90 days. After Hisdar leaves, Dany talks to Ser Barriss and Selmy, who urges her to Westeros with words that sound suspiciously like those Illyrio said to Varys. Quote, in Westeros, you will be the lost child who returns to gladden her father's heart. Your people will all cheer for you as you ride by, and all good men will love you. How did Ser Barriss didn't find Dany in the first place again? Well, anyway, Aegon the Fifth and the Ghost at High Heart are mentioned, as well as Azor Ahai and the Prince who was promised. Suspicious. Anywho, Barristan lets slip that Darian Harris is back. This excites Dany, and she goes to get ready to see him privately. After getting ready, Dany and Dario get to talking about Astapor and how it's under siege. The sanctions on the river and sea are hurting trade in Meereen. Sons of the Harpy are making things hard, too. Dario urges Dany to kill the Great Masters, as who else could be funding the Sons of the Harpy? When he tries this teaching advice, Dany finally has enough of the colorful cowboy sellsword and has him report to Barristan now rather than her. Conflicted, but having made the right choice, Dany finally goes to bed. End scene.
Nicely done, sir. Nicely done.
Nice.
Thank you.
So you volunteered for this chapter. What was it that drew you to it? Are you a fan of Dany and her storyline?
Well, it is, as you say, very isolated from the rest of the happenings. But what I find interesting about Dany is the correlations that we can draw to other characters. We'll get to the Cersei chapter later in the cast, but there is some overlap in the way that they both are sending away men who they're interested in and have feelings towards. But also, this is Now, the first time that I read this, this was very hard to get through. But as I continue in upon rereads, this is a nuanced political situation, and it's very interesting to see these kind of embargoes and blockades, and how this is now, you know, putting tremendous stress on the city of Marine, and her reactions to, you know, these problems that the city is facing is a little more measured, and she's not acting as a conquering queen and more of a governor. So it is more unique than it is of there's not a whole lot of scheming as much as reaction and more measured steps in as so far as Dany is capable of making them. So that's why I like reading her chapters upon, you know, after it was tough getting through the first time. But yeah, I'm having more respect for them. So
cool. I think I'm quite similar to you. I found it very tough first couple reads. Now I'm more into it. I have more tolerance for it, maybe because I'm not rushing to the next thing. but also I see more parallels between the situation she's in and John, and, you know, just the difficulties of ruling. I found myself actually on this reading this set of chapters kind of more frustrated at other people's meanderings than hers, which is something of a first. But it is an interesting chapter because normally she's so like, I want my dragons, and sort of entitled. Mm-hmm. She's actually being very self-sacrificing, both sexually with Dario, but also, you know, that's a big deal, offering to marry someone. So yeah, I was like, yeah. Dany is genuinely trying to do the right thing here, which I respect. Anyone not like how Dany's handling things here?
Seems to make sense, you know. Ultimately, the question is this a good decision? And I don't know. It's hard to say, you know, but what else can she do, really? She's kind of backed into a corner. She doesn't have a lot of choices. She clearly doesn't want to do this, you know?
I think it's a good decision if you want to stay in Marine and really make a go of it. Then you're going to have to compromise, right, and kind of assimilate to that culture of Marine, which includes marrying someone that they respect. But as Barristan says, if you ultimately want to go to Westeros, why would you saddle yourself with a Marinese husband when you'll need to ally with someone there? And
right,
it makes sense in the context of her current choice to be a Marine. It's just the current choice of being in Marine is the questionable one, I guess.
Right. I mean, I think Barristan in many ways is the reader, in that when he's saying, what are you doing here, Dany? Come on, let's get over to Westeros already.
Yeah, it's kind of George nodding to us like, I know.
Yeah, but speaking of Barristan, he does. What do you guys make of his comment there, where he says, "In Westeros, you'll be the last child who returns to gladness, her father's heart. Your people will all cheer for you as you ride by, and all good men will love you." Is Barristan really so, I don't know, dense to think that that's going to be the case if she were to come back? I don't know.
There's a couple of interpretations. Either he genuinely believes it, but that just seems bizarre. You've got to credit him with being more astute than that. Or maybe he thinks that just because the Civil War has been so fractious and she's the only person who can maybe have a chance of bringing peace and uniting everyone because she's got the dragons, which is, you know, out of bounds military capability. Maybe it's more that he thinks they'll just be glad of someone who can restore peace, because he's not a Targ loyalist or anything. He's not a Targ fantasist. But it is weird. I was just like, oh, you lying scumbag. But I love Barristan, and maybe it's coloured by show Barristan, because I know we're not meant to talk about the show, but he's such a... The actor who plays him has such a earnest face. I can't imagine him telling a lie ever in his entire life. So.
Well, I was suspicious because I'm thinking of the plot of Varys and Illyrio, and their ploy here is to get the realm to fall apart through civil war with you know, the dragons and lions, or I'm sorry, the wolves and lions at each other's throats, right, from game. And then we move on to when we start approaching Aegon the Sixth and the Riverblood and whatnot. We learn that this is probably their plan, to have the realm fall apart, have then, it was initially supposed to be Viserys, but now Dany, come and break apart the realm, and then with her just Dothraki, after she hatched dragons, there's a bit of a wrench thrown into that, but that was the plan, to have then Aegon swoop in and save the day from the Mad King's offspring, right? That was the idea. This is all, you know, subtext, but I think
it's not really clear yet.
It's not 100%, but that is my suspicion. And then the fact that Barristan managed to find Dany, it just rings as though maybe Illyrio is maybe feeding these kinds of lines to him. But you're right, Bina, when you say that I don't think that Barristan is intentionally, like, falsely counseling. I think he's just trying to spur her on her way. But, yeah, just Like, why would he be urging her there if he doesn't feel like... I guess he's just kind of saying cut and run for Marine, as you said, the reader.
Maybe he's just trying anything to get her out for making what he perceives to be a bad marriage and just being in a bad hole. So like a little white lie just to get her moving. Xander, any thoughts?
Not really. I do enjoy these Danny chapters, though, because I like getting the culture a bit more fleshed out. Plus, it is cool to see her, like, actually trying something else in how she's been going about being queen and everything like that, but not too much more than that.
Yeah. I do like how gung-ho Dario is. He's such a meathead.
Mm-hmm. And I was he's awesome.
And I was reading his bit where he's like, oh, and yeah, of course, lure them all in with your marriage and then we'll execute them, thinking, that's just like that's just like the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France in the Middle Ages. And then I was like, but it's just like the Red Wedding too, idiot.
It's
Red Wedding. It's Red Wedding.
The Red Wedding.
Yeah, like the Pyramid Wedding, basically. But yeah, no.
Yeah, so he's a butcher, and it's what she comes to as well.
I will give you peace in 9 days. I don't know, did any of you back in the day watch the British comedy Blackadder, the historical comedy?
Oh yeah, loved it.
Oh, fuck yeah!
So there's a brilliant episode where it's kind of like a take on Macbeth, where Blackadder's in love with his manservant, Bob, and he goes to see a witch to sort of like either, you know, cure him of his gayness or whatever. And the witch said, I give you some options. You know, you can kill yourself, you can kill Bob, but you can kill everybody else. And I kind of feel like that's what Dario is like, you know. Like, I'll give you peace in 9 days. I will just literally kill everyone and then there will be peace.
Right.
Man with the plan.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Can I just say one thing about Dario? Did you notice in there it says that his beard is purple? Has he dyed it a new color now? Because it was always blue.
I thought that his mustachios were gold and his I don't know, is it?
I thought his beard was his beard was blue and his mustachios were gold. And in this one, there's a quick mention where he like drips juice like in his purple beard, and I was like, hey, wait a minute.
Maybe he doesn't just have maybe he's just got a black beard and it's starting to grow through, and it's just kind of darkening the overall color. But who knows?
I mean, you know, girls know how hard it is to keep like colored hair, keep the toner toned.
Or maybe he's just one of those girls who likes to change his hair all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe it's just George doing a size of hips thing and he just forgot. And the
The only real reason I noticed it was because, as a funny side note, someone on some gay dating app like messaged me last week and had a blue beard, and all I could think was, oh god, I'm gonna think Dario if I ever would have seen this guy the whole time. And then I said, wait a minute, he doesn't have the gold mustachios and he doesn't have the tri-peaks, so he's out, forget it.
He might have the hot Dario,
do it right.
The other thing I was thinking with the whole Dario thing is, like, George has this habit, like, he literally says of Danny that she wouldn't care if I commanded him to stop and he didn't. And it's just like, you know, we've had all this imbroglio with the whole, like, Cersei Jamie thing, but it's as if George conceives that the way to make a sex scene really super hot, it's kind of like those old Mills and Boons novels where the girl protests that she doesn't want it, but she really does, mm-hmm. and then she swoons, and then they have really hot sex. It's like, he's trapped in this Barbara Cartland 1920s image of how a strong man takes a woman. And to modern ears, it might sound dodgy, but I think to him, he just thinks that's the ultimate like proof of hotness, you know, when the man's sheer hotness breaks through your resistance and then you really want it, you know.
Right. Which will be coming up later in this episode too, again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For sure. Don't really want to get into it, but I think you just see it time and again.
Yeah.
Dodge. Anything else?
Yeah, he won't take her roughly in the barn, she'll go find a woman to do a man's job.
Right. Which is what she does.
Weird.
I know. It really does remind me of a Barbara Cartland novel.
I do have one other comment on this chapter. Hisdar is saying, which, by the way, I think Hisdar would make an excellent ruler of Meereen. He seems to have the support of the faith in the Green Grace and the support of a good number of the people. And he also seems very confident that he can keep the peace for 90 days, which I'm curious as to how he intends on doing that. If he claims that he,
That to me is like the most glaring, stupid part in this whole chapter. Like, this is where I start to get a little frustrated, Danny. I'm like, you moron, are you serious? Like, if he can keep the peace for 90 days, then you should cut his throat.
That'll probably make things worse, though, right?
Why? Because you think it means he was causing the violence if he can turn it off.
Or
so
he knows exactly who the hell, yeah. I mean, if that's just like a tap that he can turn off, he's got to be directly involved with it, no?
Even if he isn't, if he could have shut it off, why is he saying, I'll only do it if you marry me? Yeah. Why don't you just do it?
Yeah, if you really care about the people of Marine, you would have done it back in the day.
Oh, yeah. It's like negotiating with a terrorist. It's just... As stubborn as she is and as like, I'm going to have it my way on stuff and not compromise, you know, like that's the whole reason she's here. I can't believe this. To me, it seems really out of character and just stupid.
Well, actually, you know what? I hadn't thought of that, Hannah, but you make a great point. If he can switch it off so easily, he should have done. And it is suspicious. And you're right. Like normal Danny would have probably been a little wiser to that. I think she's just so weary and beaten down. Like the green goddess, what's her name, just says like, you look really knackered. I think Danny's just really exhausted, and when you're really exhausted, I mean, this is just true, right? It absolutely compromises your decision making ability. So maybe what seems very obvious to us, it's not that Danny's stupid, I think she's just knackered, and so she's not thinking clearly and being as sharp as she should be.
Yeah, it just seems like it's so crazy. I don't know. Like, that to me was always like, what? Are you kidding? Even rereading it, it's so glaring to me and upsetting. Like, I kept thinking, like, oh, she's got to have some kind of, like, trick. Like, she's just going along with this to flush him out. And then she just takes off on that damn dragon at the end. And I'm like, what the hell are you doing? So you never had a plan. You never had a plan this whole time, you little moron. Like, I was so upset.
Really? You thought she was playing him? I never thought she was playing him.
I thought, no way. There's no way that she's not, because it's so...
We're in her head.
Like,
we're in her head. I didn't think that at all. I mean, we know
what she's... I thought, you know what I mean? Like, I just thought, God, this is like... How could you be fooled by something like that?
Because she's a kid and she's naive.
If no more crimes are committed, I'll marry you. How the hell is he going to enforce that? Like, unless he's the one doing the crimes. It just made me so mad.
Well, I do have a thought on that. It's how someone who has their roots in the culture, he probably has some suspicions, if nothing else. If he is indeed, like, innocent and he's totally telling the truth on this, like, it's not me, but hey, you know, I might be able. He's playing this long game, which is dangerous when, you know, you're doing this, but he ultimately says, like, a crown would suit me well. It's like, because he wants it, but he's also... He's not outright saying, hey, if you want peace, basically this is his card that's playing. You've got this chaotic thing going on in the city. And when you say, you know, if he really cared about the people of Marine, you have to remember that the people who are dying are the freedmen. And he may not yet consider them really people of Marine yet.
Right.
Could be.
About Tammy. He's a bag of shit. He's going to be no matter what, right? Like, I don't think he cares.
We don't know that yet. But.
Oh, I think that he is. I think they all are kind of. Come on, they're slave owners. I mean, that's the whole friggin' point. Like, that's why she's there.
I think he's more... he's more kind of just using the opportunity to gain for himself. I don't really think he's cares too much about, like, slave trade or anything like that.
Well, that's what he says. He says, like, you know, I think it's time for a new era. You know, Marine was dying, but how can that even be believed? I think it's so shady, the whole...
He's just an opportunist.
That's why, like, her chapters in this book are frustrating. This whole storyline is frustrating, because I just feel like there's sedition at every corner. Like, it's really sketchy for her, but this to me is just, it's so blatant. Like, she's being played like a puppet, and...
Well, she is a kid.
But her choices are so limited. I mean, I think that's the problem. It's like, so what else is she meant to do? Like, even if she could perceive, like, through her 3 hours sleep a night or whatever and stress that this guy is seditious, and I don't think there's as much evidence to her at this point as you're making it, Hannah, then what would her alternative be? People are still dying. There's still a terrorist threat. Like, even if you knew this guy was seditious and even if you knew he was full-on terrorist, would you still marry him to make it stop and then figure out once there was peace what you were going to do as your next move? Maybe that would just be the best interim solution. I don't know. So I'm willing to cut her some slack at this point.
I kind of
well, we
get
see
it,
what happens
that's
to
why Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just saying, we see what happened in Yunkai and Astapor. Like, the place has gone to shit as soon as she leaves.
Yeah.
And she wants to learn how to manage these kinds of situations. And in order to do that, like, this is hard, and she's gonna have to learn on the fly. And honestly, when they said that they've blockaded the bay, and that there are galleys going up the river to cut that off as well, that means that they only have overland routes. And you know, how many roads are there? And however many there are, they can probably do something about that as well. This is now becoming a place where she's essentially, like, I don't know, like an almost like a state that is being placed in a really, really bad spot. And they don't expect her, for whatever reason, to take off on a dragon. So if they can just close in on her and keep enemies within the city also, you know, causing problems, then this is actually a really, I wouldn't say elegant, but it's a really well organized kind of way of cloistering and cutting off and isolating City Marine and Danny by proxy.
Right. I mean, on some level, the City of Marine is now effectively under siege. You know, like in war in Westeros, it's under siege, it's surrounded. There's nothing you can do. And I mean, Hisdar makes a compelling argument. Remember, Danny's a kid; she doesn't have any experience with any of this stuff. And he makes a good argument. He sounds like he wants what's best for the city, and that he, of course, conveniently is what's best for the city. But it's sounds good. Like, I know the first time I read this, I wasn't suspicious at all. Now I am. And I don't know, you know, having read to the end, I still don't know what to think. You know, I know there's lots and lots of theories of who's what and who's doing what, but I'm not 100% sure of anything. But I mean, I think talking about what we just said before, though, it does sound pretty suspicious right now.
Yeah, I don't know. That's why these chapters are frustrating. He's like, on the one hand, I want her to be successful and stick to her, you know, moral duty and path of freeing these slaves. At the same time, it's like, holy shit, if you can't understand that half these people don't want you here, and unless you're going to completely be here forever, they're going to turn around and do whatever the hell they want. Like, you need to just go. You're not, this is not the battle for you.
Yeah, which is probably what Barristan is thinking, right? Which is why he lies to her and says, go home. They're going to throw garlands at your feet. I hear you, Hannah, because that frustration, believe me, I felt that for about 7 years after reading Dart. So.
Yeah, it's just, I mean.
I've just moved to a Zen state of calm.
You know?
Yeah.
And then my thing is, like, what guarantee, okay, he can keep peace for 90 days. What makes you think that for 90 seconds after you get married, he's not going to bash your skull in or something, you know? It just seems like she's setting herself up for failure, and I wish she'd just get the hell out of there. It's like, go tend your own garden before you be looking in your neighbor's. Like, go do King's Landing, and then you can come back and free all the slaves you want. You know, just get your own thing done and have more resources available to you that are your native things and not, you know, a bunch of people that you really don't know. Like, yes, you freed them, but you don't know them either, and they're not your people. They could be infiltrated by people that are going to be really detrimental to you and your cause. And then the fact that no one's pointing out to her is, like, the Seven Kingdoms says they don't have slaves, but they do. They have, like, that's just, they don't call it that, but their level of indentured servitude is insane. So why aren't you pointing that out to her more? And, like, those are your actual people, so go take care of that first.
I agree.
It's just frustrating.
I agree.
I'm sorry.
We can move on from this, otherwise we're just going to end up in a Danny wallow, and that's just going to be miserable and painful. Is there, and I've been there for years, so I don't need to go back. Right. Is anything else on the chapter, or shall we move on?
I had a few quick points.
Go
one,
for it.
we got more food porn at the beginning, but just briefly.
Yes.
George still has to throw the food porn in. I noticed that noble girls spend a year in the pleasure gardens. Does that mean even the noble girls are hookers? Is that, or are they just work there, or
no,
what?
No, I think they're more like Vestal virgins. They just float around in, like, white wispy outfits, and yeah. Not everyone in this world needs to be bonking.
Well, that's what I was like, but it's like the pleasure gardens.
So, pleasure gardens.
And they have to work there, and, like, it's implied that they all spend a year there, which I just thought was an interesting thing for nobles. Like, I mean, for the slaves or for whatever, I could see it, but for nobles, I thought that was interesting.
It's maybe of by nobles for nobles kind of deal. So that way, you know, at least you had your chance if you wanted to. There you go. If that is indeed what was happening, but
I mean, to be fair, David, the fashion statement is walking around with one tit out. So
yep.
Yeah. So.
Good point. Well made.
Oh, we did get that egg and Ghost of High Heart mentioned by Barrison. So.
Yep.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Is this the first time we heard that the Ghost of High Heart is the reason that her prophecy is the reason for the marriage and for what happened?
I believe so. Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Also, okay, he's telling Danny that, and then she goes, "What happened to her?" And he said, "Summer Hall." Was she talking about Jenny of Old Stones, or was she talking about the Ghost of High Heart? Because if that's the case, then he don't know.
I think both. Because it's believed, most people believe that they all die there, and obviously they got out, but or at least the Ghost of High Heart.
Want to go read that Arya chapter again?
But I think most people believe that, not that it's true.
Yeah,
and the prince who was promised will be born to their line. So there it is.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, in this weird little bit of a little like offside comment here, we get a major, major point for the whole story and possibly, you know, a big hint of R plus L equals J here in this Danny chapter. It's kind of weird.
There's all these little seeds sprinkled in mm-hmm. like all over the place. I love it. Mm-hmm.
On a lighter note, I loved how Dany was just such a little giddy girl when she heard that Dario's back. Like, oh, I have to get dressed up. I have to look fabulous. Oh, what can I wear? What can I do with my hair? What can I, you know? I have to look sexy. And it didn't quite work out for her that way. But
also, did it make you super uncomfortable when his dark kissed her?
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed so creepy to me. Like, the way he wrote it is just, ugh.
Well, I mean.
Oh, and he says, like, shall I kiss you again? She's like, no, I'm good.
Has George ever really written a sex or love or kiss or anything scene that hasn't been super creepy? I mean.
No, but like this, I literally got like the image of a wet fish, like a cold. You know, like that, like. Really just stupid uncle you have at Christmas when you're a little kid and he's like, come give me a hug. It's like, nah, dude. I don't know. I barely know you, man. I'm good.
Yeah. Well, Danny does seem to be hedging her bets a bit with him. So she's like, all right, well, do something for me and maybe, and that's it. So she doesn't really make a hard and fast promise.
She even compares his kiss to the fish in the
Leave George to make it about food.
I know, right? Isn't the whole Hisdar versus Dario thing really that eternal struggle between what might be best for us, or at least for what we need and in life, and what we really want and what we desire? You know, and clearly we're setting that up that we have no desire for Hisdar. It's just I might have to do this, but this, I mean, it's going to be like almost any other wedding in Westeros, in that I'm going to do this because it's going to get our family power, or it's going to do what we need to do. But damn, I don't want him.
Yeah.
Well, you just like crazy deep right there, David. I'm not ready for that.
To be fair, I would marry somebody just to be a queen or king or anything rather than chase the hot dude.
Wow, David,
just make me a trophy wife.
I want to be a trophy wife.
Points, though. I like that a lot, David.
Thanks.
Yeah. All right. I gotta wrap my head around that. Be back in five.
Any other points, David?
That's it.
Cool. Okay. Well, that was actually a very rich chapter discussion for quite a slight chapter. But as you said, a good zinger in there with a bit of a deep Westerosi history. Mm-hmm. So... after Dany 4 in Dance, we jump to Cersei 5 in Feast. This takes place on the next day, March 22nd. So I believe it is Hannah with the chapter summary.
So I feel like I wrote like this crazy long one, but that chapter is kind of long. So
I wrote a long one too. It's up to you whether you want to like split it into obvious chunks of story and then discuss that, and whether you want to just go through the whole lot and then we just discuss the whole lot. So you're cool.
I mean, it's actually probably not as long as I'm thinking it is. I'll read it, and if you don't like it, you can cut it out. I took the time to write it.
I'm not going to cut it out. It's just whether we want to discuss it. Yeah, go for it and do it.
Okay. Poor Cersei. She's being constantly bombarded by stupidity and treachery. Tommen demands to sit on the Iron Throne while Cersei gets dressed. She threatens to have Pate summoned for a beating if Tommen continues with these demands, evidently brought to his thinking by Margaery. Cersei surmises that Margaery would also have the king in his own small council meetings. How devious. Cersei, being the true queen, remembers how Robert would snore through such meetings and tells Tommen he would surely bore of them quickly. She's doing him a favor by running his kingdom for him. She waited patiently, and for so long he could wait. If she could wait, so could he. She'd rather see her son killed than have him take her hour in the sun. My gods. She's a nice young girl who paid her dues through Robert's drunken groping, and she's acquired solid ruling skills. I mean, what did they all take her giving birth to her own niece and nephews? Some frivolity? That was hardcore gameplay. Cersei has put up with so much. She has put up with her lover brother's jealous tendencies, Stannis grinding of teeth, Renly and others' attitudes. And now she must put up with the actual affairs of the realm. Something blah, 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 food, yada, yada, stays in the city. She's wary when Grandmaster Pycelle tells that Stannis Onion Knight has been put down, but only for a second when he tells her it's proof positive they saw a head with an onion above the gate. And short of fingers, it's gotta be him. Oh, okay, great. That should do for the remaining Stark bannermen, she thinks. And if you hear it from the phrase, it's got to be true, right? She reflects on Mace Tyrell's progress against Storm's End. She imagines Mace Sigil should be a fat man on his ass. She's so clever. An envoy of Braavos comes to collect on the promises of Robert's Iron Throne. Robert's promises of next year and next year have not been delivered upon. This poor woman must deal with that fat fuck's promises even after his death. From beyond the grave, she's dealing with his nonsense, all while ruling and not actually being able to sit on that damned iron chair. She speaks with Osmond Kettleblack about Osney's progress breaking in that, quote, wild filly, Marjorie. Osmond confesses that while his brother has had flirting, is willing and capable, an adequate opportunity has not yet presented itself. The young Highgarden queen is constantly surrounded by men and women. Cersei can't even use all the gold of Casterly Rock to break this younger, more beautiful queen. She has to run in. She has a run-in with Loras after finding Tommen in the practice yard trying at the Quintain. She will not appoint Loras master at arms. Cersei is confronted by her own spawn. I did it. Did you see me? I did it. And they all had those fools. This has to be somehow Tyrion and Robert's fault. When Cersei makes her presence known, they all bow except the Rose siblings. Tommen asks if his mother had witnessed his triumph, and she admits despite herself she was watching from across the yard. Marjorie questions Robert's prowess in the lists, and Cersei has to dig deep in the recesses of her mind to find attorney Robert Lance successfully into sight, as she of course was thinking about Tommen's uncle daddy Jaime when she made a comment of his father being good at it too. Cersei ponders the prospective master at arms she could appoint, then encounters Qyburn. She's just had a no good, terrible, bad day. He tells her that there are reports of dragons in Meereen, and she thinks, no, you idiot, it's harpies in Meereen. And what do slavers have to do with the slaveless Seven Kingdoms? Qyburn also has news from Dorne. Ysyrmon has taken a new wife, and something about a treacherous puppet show. Qyburn bargains for the female puppeteers, and although she is queasy at the memory of the last female Sennel that she provided for him, she still consents. She decides to take a bath to wash off the ridiculousness of her day and is interrupted by her son and his father. Her little spawn demands that his white courser be saddled and ready for training on the morrow. He wants a new kitten and no more beats. He threatens he'll outlaw beats. Jaime reports on his assigned inspection of the city gates and reminds her the roses of Highgarden are already inside the gates, and she is fully over his mansplaining things to her. She sends him off as she gets ready for her guests. She laments she's not spending the evening with Tana Merryweather, and she thinks she hasn't had a friend so good as that since Melara Heatherspoon got herself drowned. All right, she exchanges pleasantries with Felice Stokeworth about her mother's mortal broken hip. Cersei admits a new High Septim has not been chosen, and the sparrows have been somewhat of a nuisance. Sir Belmont insists that she acknowledge Lawless Child and its naming as being ill-advised by him and present company. The name Tyrion was chosen for the imps by the imp's man, Sir Bronn of the Blackwater. Poor Cersei can't escape her murderous brother and his insolent friends. She insinuates Bronn and Tyrion still have contact, and Bronn is gathering knights against her in Tyrion's name. She cries, a Tony Award-winning performance. She begs, and her act wins a commission. Bronn is marked death amid his in-laws, and the Lannister queen promises to pay her debts, though the lioness reflects she could have had a faceless man do the job for cheaper. After the seditious dinner, she finds Tommen asleep with three kittens. The kitten has three heads. And begins to remember begins to remember her turn of fate. Had things gone just a wee bit differently, she'd have been Rhaegar's queen, and she'd have never looked back. Even in his grave, Rhaegar was better than her golden-handed twin. Everything was a failure. Her father, Robert, Jaime, her son, her king. Only she succeeded. Only she is worthy. And Bronn would soon learn how sharp this lioness's claws are.
Oh, that was long, but it was so funny. It was very funny. I feel that you don't like Cersei as much as I like Cersei.
Right. You definitely got the tone.
Yeah.
I love her.
I just imagine Hannah reading these chapters and like just thinking, like, frustrated at Dany and then hating on Cersei and just being in a really bad mood.
Well, I mean, she really did get the tone of Cersei's, of the whole chapter so well, because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, that was just a modern reinterpretation of the actual tone of the chapter. I mean,
she's so extra.
She spends the whole chapter just being entitled and, oh, I deserve this, and, oh, I have to actually, like, work. I mean, it's so ironic that she fought so hard to, you know, get this power, and now she hates it, you know? And she feels so entitled. She feels so entitled, yet women have no power in this world, but yet she feels entitled. So it's like this weird contradictions of her.
Have you ever just been like really pissed off and then everything is pissing you off?
Yes, like, routinely, on the regular.
Like, okay, so I feel like that's Cersei with just all the time. Like
all the time.
But do you not like, I tell you what, this is the reason, even when she's doing hateful shit, like giving Qyburn women, even though he knows he's doing horrible stuff to them. Like, there are certain things about her pissed offness when she's moaning about how she's had to wait, which really resonate with me as a woman in corporate life. Like, for everything that she does that is really horrific, there's something else that she expresses about the injustice of being a woman in the world that really resonates with me. And it's sad that it comes in the form, like, through the mouth of Cersei, because she's such a vile human being. But some of that resentment isn't wrong. You know, when she talks about when she dressed up as a little boy and, you know, even her father treated her differently. It wasn't just that men looked at her differently. And I just kind of feel for that, you know, being made to feel less than for being a woman. So now she's queen. She's going to be extra. She's going to take back all that diminishment, all that less than-ness, and make it into being extra. And this is her time. And I kind of feel that. I also kind of secretly feel that this is what Prince Charles is going to be if he ever becomes king. He's going to be like, damn you all motherfuckers, I waited 50 years to be king and now it's my turn. He's going to be vile. And then hopefully he'll quickly die and then Prince William can take over.
Right.
Oh dear. And Prince William's so popular. Even like Harry and Meghan, like honestly, like anyway, sorry, I'm derailing again. Back to the chapter.
I mean, the thing that I find so interesting about Cersei is that, you know, on some level she's played as the villain, and on some level, you know, she's an awful leader and she doesn't want to do any work and she's bitchy and she's all these things you want to hate about her. But most of her, you know, most of her anger and her is righteous and legitimate. At least some of it is. I mean, it has a basis in real issues, and she is legitimately, you know, she has a legitimate reason to feel aggrieved because women are treated badly. And yet, even when she gets that power, even when she gets everything she wants, she's horrible. She's a horrible person. I mean, we listen to her just bitch and bitch and bitch about everyone around her. And, oh, I have to do work and I have to deal with the money and I have to deal with the ships and I have to deal with this and that. And, oh, why do I have to do all this work? I'm like, well, the reason you have to do this work is because you wanted it and you fought for it and you got it.
Well, that's I do. Like most of the time with Cersei, it's like you can always say, oh, hold on one second. Sorry. I do feel for her because, you know, at least she's like always putting her children first. But after Joffrey dies, then you realize it's not that she's putting her children first. She always put him first.
Right.
Some weird dynamic there, you know, because she's kind of abusive to Tommen, like in this chapter. And I think it was the last reread.
She's not actively abusive, is she? She's just keeping him in check.
She's really dismissive to him, and she's not kind to him. Like the, when we did,
but I mean, there's a difference between an absence of kindness and active abuse, right? I mean, she's just more disinterested.
Well, she can abuse him though, because
he's king.
Because he's the king. So instead, she threatens to abuse the whipping boy.
But neither do I think she wants to abuse him. I don't think she would. She loves her kids, and she would protect them. But she just wants to rule, and she's not wrong, right? I mean, he is a kid. He fucking wants to outlaw beats and play with pussycat.
Yes.
So he's not qualified to rule. He doesn't need to be anywhere near ruling.
Which is fair, but at the same time, he also wants to learn to fight, and he wants to do the things that will make him
only because Marjorie told him to.
But regardless,
she doesn't have a conversation with him.
But
she doesn't actually sit and speak to her son with love and go, listen, we can't outlaw beats because that's good nutrients to other people, and you need to think about those kind of things as king. She just tells him to go fuck off, and she does it at Tywin's funeral too. She's really unkind to him.
But unkind, I do feel, is different to abusive. Like, maybe because I've just been watching the first episode of the Patrick Melrose miniseries today, where, you know, a father basically rapes his son. I mean, like, there is a difference, right? So she's unkind.
Well, she's not physically abusive. You can incur some mental abuse.
Do you think she's really emotionally
abusive?
Do you think she's that bad?
I don't really. Here's what I think. I think that she is going out of her way to put someone or to put her son's interests behind her own, and although that may not be outright abuse, it's not doing him any favors. And what he wants right now is to be taught to learn how to joust and fight. And even Jaime comes in later and is like checking Cersei's, like, hey, you know, he wants this, and he, you know, this is what he needs to do. And she's totally dismissive of now both Loras, who says,
do you think she's really putting his interests behind? I mean, she's definitely wants to rule, but she wants to rule ultimately because she wants to preserve the crown for Lannisters and for her son's inheritance. No, I mean, it's not the two don't have to be.
I think it's exactly the same kind of attitude that Tywin had with his kids. I want everything for the family, and family in quotes, because he's not actually helping with his own family.
That's the delicious irony, Ty, isn't it, that she always criticizes her dad for family first and blah blah blah, and then she does exactly the same when she has the chance.
But how does telling
Tommen not to fight? I mean, okay, part of this is her own paranoia about Margaery. But I mean, at the same time, she's like, yeah, we'll find him one. But she's not really like sincerely wanting to find him. Someone, you remember, we're in her head. She doesn't sound really all that interested in helping him learn to fight, helping him learn to be a better king. It's very much a let me stop that bitch. You know, it's all about stopping Margaery, which is a threat to her. Because I mean, maybe on some level she thinks of Margaery as a threat to Tommen, but realistically she's a threat to her, and that's what comes before anything, and that certainly comes before her son, unfortunately. And I think that's the big problem. You know, she could be like, hey Jaime, let's get him someone to do this and let's do that, but she's totally disinterested. She's just making an excuse. Oh yeah, we'll find some guy from Dorne, and you know, that'll probably happen in 3, 5, 6 years. You know, he's young, he's at the age he should be doing this now, he should be learning that stuff. Jaime even says it, and she's like, you know, whatever.
I will say, up to this point, we have been shown that besides Joffrey, she's essentially just negligent with her other children, even more so now that you get to see with Tommen being her only son now, she's, again, just kind of ignoring him and kind of a little paranoid because she already lost the one son that she actually cared about. You know, she's more negligent with Tommen and Myrcilla than anything, I think. I don't think it's outright, like, intentional abuse or anything like that. She just doesn't care the way she did with Joffrey.
It almost makes me wonder, like, is she kind of putting more of a wall up between them because, you know, after Joffrey died, like, to kind of protect her from more pain.
But I can see that.
I also don't think that Cersei has that sort of depth in her line of thinking. But it makes me really curious to see, like, had we gotten a POV of her prior to the Purple Wedding and Tywin's death.
Yeah.
How she would have internal monologued her views of them, and would that be really contrasting? Because it just seems like it is, with given what we know how she behaved from other people's POVs toward Joffrey. It seems really conflicted with how she treats Tommen. But because we don't have that, I guess we do. Like, fair point, Bina. It's, you know, we have kind of a lack of information there. And yeah, it's not necessarily abuse, but it's not great mothering either. And it's not great ruling either, you know. And above all, the person who Cersei is most abusive towards is herself at the end of the day. You know, she's a very troubled woman. She's very crazy. I love her. I love reading her. I love talking about her. She'd just be one book of just her.
I love her little slip when she goes to Tommen, "Jousting's in your blood. One day you'll rule the list like as your father did."
And then she's
thinking of Jaime. Like, oops. I love that little slip there.
I like how she like pulled that one out. She's like, "Oh, I'm surprised you didn't know that story, idiot."
Right. She just made
that
it
one
up.
Time.
Like, totally made that up.
Like, oh boy.
Then this candle she holds for Rhaegar still. It's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's just like Robert.
Right. There's the line she has, she'd never forgiven Robert for killing him, Rhaegar, which I thought was really fascinating because she really does. You know, when you get to that whole bit where she starts thinking about Rhaegar and her time with him and how much she desired him. I mean, in a lot of ways, I felt like I was reading a Sansa chapter for that part of it. You know, she was very much the giddy girl. I'm going to marry the king, the prince. I'll be the queen. And he's so beautiful and he's so hot. And look at his blonde hair. Or whitish blonde,
well,
you know, whatever.
Point. Like, I have so much sympathy with her. She has this childhood where she knows her dad's never going to take her seriously because she's a girl. But nonetheless, she is this pretty little Sansa type girl insofar as she falls for Rhaegar. And then that's cruelly snatched away from her, and she just becomes very bitter about it. So I don't like who she's become, but I think it's really authentic as a reaction that she becomes that person. And
yeah,
it really reminded
me. But I agree with you.
And it really reminded me a lot of, you know, the kind of the mythology about how Anne Boleyn potentially was secretly married to Harry Percy, but then wasn't seen as Aristo or like highborn Aristo enough to marry the son of the Duke of Northumberland, and so was secretly sort of gotten rid of. And apparently at that point is when she had the ambition to sort of get her revenge on people by becoming all powerful by marrying the king. And I think it's a lot of what happens at Cersei's court reminds me of what it must have been like to be in the court of Henry VIII with, you know, trying to set up Margaery with a lover so she can be executed lawfully and all this sort of stuff.
Right, right.
And so I know she does horrid stuff, but I do sympathize. I really do.
Here's an interesting, you know, alternative history thing. Let's say she had married Rhaegar. Do you think she'd still be, you know, desiring power like she does now? Or would she just be happy to live the, like, Sansa fantasy life?
Oh, I think if she had been happily married to him, she would have been happy. But he would have ended up, like, going with someone else. And then she would have become bitter and vengeful for another reason, maybe.
Right. If he ended up going off with Lyanna, she might have then just gotten just as nasty for Lyanna.
Do you not, like, see the trouble with that is that she was already with Jaime?
This is
like
true.
By the time she's thinking of that, it's
Jaime is a real man, and Jaime's just a boy, and Rhaegar's a real man.
You know what I mean? Like the omissions that she has, even in her own internal thinking, it's so odd. So
in this counterfactual history, would she still be fucking Jaime if she was married to Rhaegar? What do you think?
I don't think so.
Sorry, Zander.
No, it's okay. I honestly think for Cersei, Jaime's always just been convenience.
Yeah. Yep.
I think it's a narcissistic, like, looking into a mirror of what I could have been kind of thing, which...
That too, yeah.
Definitely.
I don't... Yeah, even Jaime does have that line. I think when he's with Brienne, what would you? She said something like, "What would it be if you were a woman?" And he just kind of shuts down that. He's like, "Well, if I were a woman, I'd be Cersei," and that's it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think one time I briefly proposed the idea of what if they had been born same sex, would they still?
Ooh, interesting.
That is an interesting question.
Relationship.
I don't know.
In this world, I don't know.
I'm going to have to chew on that.
I don't know. There's Loras is in this chapter. Loras is in this chapter. He's gay, right? So, and what's more, I feel like I need to take a moment for Loras, right? Because he seems to be earnestly trying. He's not seeming to be plotting or anything. He's just working on getting getting Tommen, up to speed, so to say.
He's just good people, right?
Which is his job. Yeah. I mean, that's like what you should do. I mean, in this world, he would already be probably Loras's squire.
Yeah, in peacetime. I mean, let's admit there's been a lot of disruption lately. So.
Right.
Cersei's operating like Trump. She hasn't filled all the posts yet, and she's going to get to it, but she's under siege.
and she got the power, but doesn't really want it.
I mean, the narcissism is still there, right?
Want to do any of the work, you know, because that's, I mean, you get Trump does not want to do any of this governing crap. He just wants to be in charge and be the big guy, which is certainly where Cersei is right now. She wants all the glory and that, but I have to deal with this crap, you know.
I want to make a minor note, but it really pissed me off and frustrated me. So, because today I read the Cersei 4 and Cersei 5 chapter, because I had to catch up on my episode 74 chapters. So, in Cersei 4, she agrees that Orin Waters can build 3 warships to replace the fleet, and that she's not going to pay the Iron Bank to fund it. That was a week ago, and in this chapter, Orin Waters tells her the first one's already ready. Like, I know it's not the same as building a modern battleship, but a week seems frightfully quick to knock up a warship. That just really annoyed me.
I'm guessing that's a mistake.
In the way that Nadia gets annoyed about people not wearing helmets.
Right. Unless they went to Braavos, because Braavos can make it really quick.
Yeah, but you can't even sail to Braavos and back in, you know.
That's true.
Unless they had one off the shelf they could just buy.
I was going to say, unless they already had people building ships, maybe, or already hired somebody that was they had half a ship built and he got the okay. So he was like, hey, that half of the ship finished up. It's mine.
Yeah, maybe. That makes sense. We'll give that a pass, Mimi.
What it is that he built the models of the ships. Instead, they were done, but he just didn't say the word.
Had her look.
He said
really
the word model.
Away.
He's looking through mirror's glass. See, it's out in the bay. Let go.
And then my final point wasn't a point, but a question. It was I don't know if you guys can remember the first time you read this, or whether it was before the show or not, but when you read it the first time, did you think that Davos was really dead? Because I normally fall for George's ruses, but something I just never believed it. I was like, a couple of phrases.
I
refused to believe it.
Thinly veiled. Like, you can get any schmuck who's already dead and chop his hands and knuckles. I'm like, please. Exactly.
Plus, it's Davos, and you can't just kill him off screen and then have him off screen.
Cool. Any other comments on the Cersei chapter, or are you happy to move on to the behemoth that is Jaime?
A couple of quickie ones. I find it amusing that Cersei now enjoys eating boar.
She's being a fat drunkard like her husband, right?
Right? It's like, ha ha ha. Like, you can tell every time she eats this, she's going, revenge is so tasty. And then she spends a lot of time thinking about Jaime's stump.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she just talks about it a lot. I noticed she mentions it at least 3 times and just in this one chapter. A couple other quick things. Qyburn is just so creepy. I mean, even when he barely appears.
I get him though. I get his deal.
What is his deal?
His deal is he's a scientist, man. He's like, he's
Dr.
like
Frankenstein.
Yeah, you know, it's fine.
But that's creepy.
He's like, you know,
that's
he's
creepy,
like,
right?
I mean, he has girls screaming in the basement. What's creepy is that he doesn't mind that he has girls screaming in the basement for his science.
Yeah, and he only seems to be interested in collecting women for his experiments. I don't think that there's anything sexual necessarily, but I think someone mentioned that this might be like some terrible early stem cell research or something. I don't know what's going on down there, but I don't necessarily
I don't
even want to know.
I think
it's better.
I think it's science, but it's just some kind of weird reproductive mutilation style weirdness.
I mean, honestly, if these people are already condemned to death and he's trying to study death, You know, I mean, it's not great to torture anyone, but I guess.
So, is he like Dr. Frankenstein and Jack the Ripper, kind of?
Or Mangala. Mangala.
Ooh, there you go.
He's Mangala, right? Or he, and Frankenstein combined into one because, right. I don't know. It's not.
He's good. Not. He's not the Ripper because he doesn't seem to be getting off on it.
But. No, he's not getting off on it. But there's certain. He reminds me of Count Rugen in The Princess Bride.
Well,
be honest about how you're experiencing this torture. Yeah. It's for science. Oh no, what does he say?
Yeah.
It's for posterity. And try to be factual. Try to be specific on how you experience this. It's for posterity.
Your answers to the form of a question.
Exactly.
Why?
Yeah. So he's Count Rugen, but he's also politically quite astute for a man who doesn't really have experience in it.
Right.
Well, I think that he's also really transparent, though, too, which is why I think I like him. He just seems like, this is my motivation. He doesn't have, like, ulterior motives. He just wants to do his thing. He'll take it from anyone he can get it from.
I really like the character of Qyburn. I just detest what he does. Similar to Cersei, I love her character, but she's an awful person. You probably just should die already, but I would miss her.
I hope she lives into the bitter end. I want to see her just go batshit crazy at the end. She'll literally like be in the throne room with like a torch, you know, like swinging it in a circle to get everyone off. Like, it wasn't me. Mm-hmm. I love it.
I'm not saying that it's bad that he's creepy. Some of the most interesting characters in these books are creepy, but he's creepy. And on the other end of the spectrum, you got to love Tommen. I mean, other kings want to conquer and do all this stuff, and he just wants to joust. He wants a kitten, and he doesn't want to eat beets.
He's just such a sweet boy.
Right? And with this awful mother.
Yeah, I love him, though.
Like, I love Tommen and Marcella for sure. They're such sweethearts.
They are. I know. I really hope nothing bad happens to them, but it probably will.
Yeah, there are three kittens. I'm expecting one of them to die, and then a second, and then a third as foreshadowing, but who knows? Yeah. I hope not.
Oh, there you go. Not Sir Pounce!
We'll know if that's confirmed. If a kitten dies by drinking poison, that'll be canon.
Someone poisons the food or the herb liquid or whatever, water.
I do have a point, though. Like, I do think that it's really interesting. She does give pause to thinking about Sanel and feeling guilty about it.
Right.
You know, she condemned her to death. The method of her dying obviously does disturb Cersei, you know, a bit.
It's the most regret we've ever seen her have, really, of something she did bad.
Yeah.
I think she just feels uncomfortable with it. I don't know that she's regretting her action necessarily, though. Sure. She just feels uncomfortable with it. And what's more is that Cersei also has, I think, drawn... I was wondering, like, has Cersei always been this way, or was it maybe after the spurn of Rhaegar and Aerys of Tywin's proposal... was that what made it, you know, her kind of duplicitous like this? But actually, she mentions that she drew, there's the well scene where she throws her friend down a well. And then there's also the part where she draws a picture of her and Rhaegar on a dragon flying together. Yep, and when Jaime asks what it is, like, how old is this girl at this point where she's doing this, is now saying, that's not me and Rhaegar. This is Jaehaerys and Good Queen Alysanne.
Heartbreaking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, and she almost squeezes Tyrion's cock off, right?
Yeah, you're right. So there's no...
She was before
like
this,
eight then. That's what I'm saying is like she... I think that it's a combination of nature and nurture with her.
Right, right.
I think that she is by nature... She doesn't have all her chairs pulled up to the table.
The thing I always think with her is how different would her life have been if her mother had lived and actually provided some parenting and some guidance.
Right. And if her mother had lived and she'd gotten to marry Rhaegar, she might have been a totally different person.
But that's the thing, though, is like she's clearly a couple ticks off because Tyrion was a baby and Oberyn is having this memory of her being physically.
Well, the only reason that she tried to do that was because he killed my mother, right? That's what she says. Right. So I mean,
that's in you. That's something that's in you. You know what I mean? Like that's.
That could have been. I mean, losing your mother at such an early age is a very traumatizing event that will have a major effect on your life. Oop.
No doubt.
Yeah, I'm also willing to give people. I mean, it's horrific, but I give her not a total free pass, but kind of a medium pass or whatever. I don't know. But
we can passive understanding.
Yeah, I have some sympathy.
Well, I'm not going to naysay that because I don't give Kat any passes and everyone always naysays me. So.
Fair enough.
For what it's worth, I do not naysay you. She deserves everything she gets.
So, Ty, you're with Hannah. You're excited.
Okay, a bit because I don't like her chapters. But.
After Cersei 5, we jump to Jaime 3 in Feast. This takes place on the next day or begins on the next day, March 23rd, and we skip over two chapters and 30 pages to get there. And I believe it is Xander with an epic summary of just an amazing chapter. So you go.
Yes, because Jaime is the best, as everybody knows.
I mean, I'm in love with Jaime, so.
Of course you are.
It might be a little bit of a long summary because it was really hard to like cut any content because I just wanted to put like I pretty much just wanted to read the chapter. It's that good. So the chapter opens with Cersei complaining of Jaime's beard, saying he looks like Robert. He points out that Robert's beard was black and his is gold. Gold or silver, his sister asks, and plucks a hair from his chin, and it was a gray hair. All the color is draining from you, Cersei insists. She calls him a ghost of what he was, bloodless, and always in white. Cersei prefers Jaime in crimson and gold. In his weaning affection, Jaime thinks he prefers her dappled in sunlight with water beating on her naked body. And as quickly as that thought came to him, so too did the thought of her fucking Lancel, Osmond Kettleblack, and Moonboy for all he knew. Which, that's the only time I put that in here, but he does say that four different times in the span of two pages. They continue their conversation as Jaime tries to convince Cersei that this is folly and his place is by the king's side. She tells him his place is wherever the king sends him. They argue on the plans of sending Jaime to Harrenhal and Riverrun, leaving Sir Osmond in charge of the King's Guard in Jaime's absence. Cersei's thoughts on Sir Loras, and after a comment about Sir Osmond leering at Cersei's breast, she slaps him and commands him to leave. Outside the Red Keep stables, 40 knights and as many squires were waiting for Jaime, many of whom were Westernmen sworn to the Lannisters, many others newly made friends of foes. Jaime's two horses, a blood bay and a gray stallion, were called Honor and Glory by a squire, which Jaime found amusing and let the name stand. Glory wore Lannister trappings, Honor the whites of the Kingsguard. He mounted up, and a squire asked if he should want his new hand. No, Jaime thinks, let them see the stump, let them see the cripple. Making their way out of the city, the column was only seen off by peddlers crying their wares, a few whores, and some sparrows espousing doom to 100 city folk. Most of Jaime's command awaited him outside the city walls. Sir Adam Marbrand and his outriders, Sir Stefan Swift and with the baggage train, Sir Bonifer's Holy Hundred, Sarsfield's mounted archers, Maester Julian and four cages of ravens, and 200 heavy horse led by Sir Flemont Brax. Fewer than 1,000 men altogether, but there was already a Lannister army at Riverrun and a host of Freys. Still near to the city, there was still livestock and apples on the trees, berries, barley corn, oats, and winter wheat. Wains and ox carts still on the road as well, but Jaime knew as they went on it would not be so. In the evening, they had made camp under the hilltop castle of the Hayfords. Jaime was then invited to sup with the castellan. He took several of the lords riding with him, and Ilyn Payne as well. He also decided to wear his new hand, a golden hand crafted lifelike and inlaid with mother-of-pearl fingernails with thumbs somewhat bent to hold a goblet of wine. During the dinner, the castellan asked if there was any word on young Tyrek Lannister, who had been missing since the riot in King's Landing. The lords about him argued on what could have happened to the boy, only ending when Jaime said the boy is dead. But later that night when he was alone, Jaime's thoughts went to Varys and thinks he may be behind young Tyrek's disappearance. That night as well, Jaime and Ilyn started their nightly dancing practice. 6 days traveling north on the King's Road, they began to see signs of war, weeds and wary animals and no travelers to be seen. During the night, they knew the wolves ruled this place. They came across a tower house called Sow's Horn, and Jaime was interested to learn of wolves, the two-legged kind. Some Karstarks had been about looking for Jaime, but Sir Roger had run them off before they had come. However, a group of lions led by Sir Amory Lorch had come a little bit before that. Amory and his men slaughtered half of Sir Roger's sheep, some goats, and attempted to burn the tower house. Wolves on four legs came later, eating the remainder of the sheep. When asked what Sir Roger should do, Jaime tells him to plant and pray for one last harvest. As they drew closer and closer to Harrenhal, the lands grew grayer and bleaker. Finally seeing the large towers of the castle, Sir Adam's outriders reported that gates were barred. Jaime had commanded Sir Kenos to sound the horn of Harrock, and after three blasts, they were allowed entrance. Which I do want to point out, the horn of Harrock was a twisted black horn banded in old gold. A handful of Sir Gregor's men were still there, and a man called Shitmouth was the one to greet Sir Jaime. Jaime asked the man if he has command. "Shit no, my lord. Bugger me with a bloody spear," he says. After repeating the phrase again, Jaime retorts to Sir Ilan to find a nice long spear and shove it up his ass. A different man shouted that Polliver was in command, only the hound killed him, the tickler, and the Starsfield boy as well. Jaime asks how he knew it was Sandor, and the man tells him the innkeep had told them. Jaime learns that they never sent men after the hound out of fear, Jaime says, but Shitmouth says they left it for better men like Jaime himself. Jaime commands for the garrison and captives to all be brought into the Hall of 100 Hearths. He also asked to see Vargo Hoat. When brought to him, Hoat was no more than a rotting head, eaten by crows and the other captives. Apparently, the mountain had fed bits of him to all the captains and Hoat himself, so he got to eat a piece of himself before he died. Jaime then addresses the garrison, saying that Sir Bonifer Hasty will hold Harrenhal in the name of the crown. They may stay, shall Hasty have them, and the rest will join Jaime on his march to Riverrun. Jaime then asks to see the captives, starting with Willis Manderly. Three of Lady Wen's people were left, Paya amongst them, who was in much worse condition than the last time Jaime saw her. He tells her she will no longer be hurt, and then he informs Willis he will be escorted to Maidenpool and put on a ship to White Harbor. Later, Jaime supped with Sir Bonifer Hasty, who refused to have any of Gregor's men. He also refuses to keep Paya. Jaime, after a small conversation, agrees to take both Gregor's men and the girl. Jaime takes his leave after giving some final orders and goes to find Sir Ilan for practice. He's surprised to find Sir Ronnet in the bear pit and goes to him. He's there to see where Brienne fought the bear. He explains how he was betrothed to her and rejected her, and then mocks her as well, calling her a freak. Jaime slaps him with his golden hand and makes him say her name. And at this point, to end, this is where I read the last passage. Jamie's golden hand cracked him across the mouth so hard the other night when stumbling down the steps. His lantern fell and smashed, and the oil spread out burning. "You are speaking of a high-born lady, sir. Call her by name. Call her Brienne." Connington edged away from the spreading flames on his hands and knees. "Brienne, if it please my lord." He spat a glob of blood at Jamie's foot. "Brienne the beauty." And that is it.
Oh, well done, sir. That was so epic. Oh, it's a great chapter.
It's one of my favorite ones.
It's weird.
Why is it one? Sorry, David. Let's just let Xander comment on why he loves it, and then we'll get to comment. So, why is this one of your favorite chapters, Xander?
A lot of reasons. So Jaime's POV, honestly, my favorite arc in the entire book, or books. But this one especially because he's leaving King's Landing behind, which kind of works as a metaphor for him leaving his old life behind, now acting as the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard and trying to keep that. And there's so much that happens in this chapter, and just hearing his internal monologue throughout this entire trek and like the people he interacts with, that's why I had such trouble condensing it, because there's so many good interactions that he has with different lords and knights and everything. He's the best person in the world.
No.
I agree. David, do you disagree? Because that's going to be contentious.
That's what my feeling was. It's weird because it's almost like three chapters in one. You've got first the like breakup and the leaving of King's Landing, which is great. Then you've got this long section in the middle of him like moving on. And the only part I felt that part was really tedious to me. And in fact, literally, I was reading this morning as I was going to, before I went to bed. I sleep weird, but I literally fell asleep reading it and then would wake up and read a paragraph and then fall back asleep. It was very strange.
Is it because you've already seen Brienne see the damage done to small folk and ordinary people?
Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed like we've already gotten that, and I just felt like it was just, there wasn't much to it to me that was interesting. Then we get to, you know, the end and that whole bit with like the bear pit and all that, and that part's really cool once we get to Harrenhal. So it's like I almost feel like it should have been broken up at least into at least two chapters, if not three.
Do we want to talk about it in that way? Because that might be easier to frame the discussion. Mm-hmm. I was wondering. So
yeah.
Maybe
yeah,
thoughts on the whole Cersei, Jaime. There's obviously like a residual sexual attraction there, but he feels betrayed that she's been fucking other people. She probably feels I'm ruling now. I have less use for him. I don't know what, but what are your thoughts on her sending him away?
Better for him?
Yeah.
He probably doesn't think of it that way. He doesn't think of it that way.
Not yet, at least. So, it's almost like a blessing in disguise for him, I think.
Oh, it definitely is.
He's been sent to rehab.
But he's not happy about it, clearly. I mean, he doesn't want this.
Why do you think she does it?
So she can fuck Osni Kettle Black.
Osmond.
I think she's just done with him. I think she's, you know, she hasn't really wanted him since he came back without his hand and incomplete.
Right.
And she's been kind of using him as much as she could. And now she needs, you know, she can use him better away, going off to do work rather than keep him around. And then she still has to fuck him. And
I wonder if some of it's also to do with, pun not intended, with him refusing to be her hand. It's like her dream is to rule.
Right.
So if he would have been part of that dream and helped her, she would have really been solid towards him. But mm-hmm. when he was like bugging out of that, then it's like, well, you're just another schmo that I may or may not choose to fuck or use.
Right.
And I think a big part of it too is his new path. You know, he's trying to be a proper Lord Commander, and mm-hmm. you know, here, let me find the quote. Too, I wanted to put in my summary, but obviously I couldn't. She asks him why he's so reluctant to like do all this, and makes comment like, "Did you lose your courage with your hand?" And he tells her mm-hmm. that he swore an oath to Lady Stark to never take arms up against the Starks or the Tullys.
Right.
And she responds, "A drunken promise made with a sword at your throat." Which is how she views it, but mm-hmm. through his inner monologue, we can obviously see that he actually does value that oath. And even, you know, the chapters of his after this, you could see he's making a really, really big effort to honestly stop the warfare, period.
Right.
She doesn't respect that. He has a really deep desire to not be known as an oathbreaker and the Kingslayer. She doesn't respect that.
Well, and more to the point. And more to the point, he's now setting out on his own with real goals for himself and things he wants, and it's not all about her, and that's what it should be to her. Like, why would he want anything other than to help my power, to push me into right. better places? And then once he wants his own stuff, he's useless to her, you know?
Yeah,
let's send him off on a mission.
It's all to her. Like, she takes him down from the shelf when she's ready to play with him, mm-hmm. and when she's not, she puts him back on the shelf, and he should sit there and wait on her pleasure. And now he's a broken doll, so she's going to go find a new
prettier
doll
one. Yeah. There is a kind of irony with that when we first meet them in book one. There's a joint narcissism and a self-regard in their relationship and an arrogance. Nothing matters other than them. I'll push a kid out of a window just so I can have what I want. And she's still in that narcissistic frame of mind. And his horizons have been opened. And I think it's the tragedy for me of Jaime and Cersei is, as we leave them in the books, that she has no inkling about the man he's becoming, and he doesn't feel able to articulate that to her, because as he leaves now on this journey, he's not even aware of it himself to articulate it. He's aware of doing it, but I don't think he could frame it that clearly. So at the end of these books, they're so widely apart, and I think that's a true tragedy of what was a very fucked up, but ultimately was a genuine kind of a love at the start, I feel.
Yeah, they're both growing distance. Yeah, I mean, they're both disenchanted with one another at this point to some extent. Cersei being that he's, as you say, incomplete, and that what's more is that Jaime is not being what he was before to her, which was right. essentially a yes man, and you know, whatever you say, like, and when she's and he confronts her with Tommen in our other chapter, and in this one, Cersei is belittling him, and she may have always done that, but he may have always just gotten used to it. But at this point, maybe he's thinking like, wow, this is not how other people, like Brienne, for instance, had talked to him. And I'm wondering if we're not going to see a character shift, as the thing that was most important to Jaime was taken away from him, his sword hand. And then maybe the thing that's most important to Cersei, being her social standing, is taken away from her. We can see that maybe how these characters will diverge in their, because they're twins, right? They're in a novels, you'll generally see these kind of adverse reactions, and maybe we'll see how one twin deals with it. Jaime seems to be taking more of a noble approach to it and wanting to be honest man. I wonder how Cersei will take her loss of standing and stature as the books go on.
Yeah, I think the most important thing about their relationship to her is the control over him. It's the one area of her life she had total control over, and now she doesn't have it. And I don't want to get into like cat bait or anything, but
yes, you do.
I don't, but almost everyone, the most unforgivable thing that Kat does is letting Jaime go. It's the one thing that I defend her on, and I completely agree with. And this is the ramification of that coming down the line now, just with what that does to his psyche. She bothered to trust him, such as the trust was available. And I think that it's a respect he's not been given most of his life, and certainly not after Aerys. And that means a lot to him. And it's not just Brienne that changes him. It's that action too. And it will have major consequences going forward, I think, for the better. And so it's the one thing I'll defend Kat all day, every day about, like, not just the decision itself in that moment, but now look at how it's shaping his character going
forward. He may end up becoming one of the heroes now because of Kat's move there.
Although, in fairness, Kat could not have foreseen that, and her decision was much more self-interested.
That's not really what I want to get into right now, but you know,
I know what you mean, Hannah.
His reaction to it that is really crucial to his development as a human being for the better. And again, Cersei could never possibly understand that or respect him for it. You know, if he were to confide an emotion like that in her, she would say something like, well, that's stupid, woman, and haha, you know, like, she's so dismissive.
She's just not on the same page, right?
She's selfish. Yeah. She's selfish, and he's now trying to think beyond himself, which is good. One thing, there's one line in this chapter, though, actually two, but that I think really put an interesting twist on it all, on the dynamic between them, because we keep talking about how Cersei controls him, and he does what she wants and all that. But there's one line in here that I thought was really interesting, where he says he wanted to rip her gown off and turn her blows to kisses. He'd done it before, back when he had two good hands. So first of all, that kind of changes that power dynamic, because because meanwhile, she's saying no, and he's doing it. And at least in his mind, he's done this before. Now, whether he's a reliable narrator or not, we can debate. But if he's telling the truth, that's something that's happened before. It also is an interesting thing to think of, you know, when we think back on our long debates on the Sept scene, where you know, that happens. He's saying he's done this before, and you know, it sounds like he's done it, and he said he did it back when he had two good hands, so that's not just the Sept scene, it's happened before that. So that might put that scene in context a little bit as well. This is their dynamic. She controls him in life, but in bed he can kind of get her around, and she's okay with it. So that's an interesting twist.
Very unhealthy.
I think that goes back to what we were talking about with George and his way of writing a male-female romantic relationship. Whereas it has to be the strong man that can take charge of the
bodice ripping.
Yeah.
I don't know, Ty, if this is exactly what you're saying, but so this might be redundant, but I do think that she sends him away and is done with him. Like you were saying, it's that narcissism. He's the mirror image of her. He's her ideal of what she could have been. And he comes back with no hand, and that mirror is cracked.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
it's not this looking glass that she can have this fantasy with anymore. And I think it disgusts her.
Yeah, and what's kind of interesting about
it is it's a more accurate image of her.
Yeah. She has absolutely no interest in what he would be as Cersei. Cersei, the only reason I think that she has that idea about Jaime is because that's where the power lives in the society that they're in. Right. So
that male-centric society.
Yeah, Cersei has even had the thought, if only I had a cock.
Right.
Yeah. And some of the relations that she has, in this book, in fact, is a little little dodgy there.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. It's abusive.
For sure.
She's one sick puppy. I love her.
David, before you need to run out, is there anything you want to say on the final two sections? I mean, I know you weren't enamored of the middle one, but maybe the last section quickly before you go?
Yeah. A couple of things. This is obviously a larger discussion, so I'll let you talk about it, but we'll probably want to discuss where Tyrek might be. I don't know, but so that's my thing. But I really liked in the middle, I liked his training with Cyril and Payne, and it's as close as Jaime gets to a real solid healing and a new start. It's a nice diversion after the break. Up, but it gives him a chance to really like build himself into something again, even if he's not all that successful at it as it seems. And I also love that Jaime pretends that his bruises from that came from frolicking with women, because somehow that scene is better. You know, like, oh, I heard these were bite marks from the crazy women I was with last night, instead of, yeah, I'm trying to actually fight and be a good warrior and I'm failing miserably. You know, this says a lot about the culture, about Jaime as a character and everything around them there, right? Another bit is the wolves that they run into. That's got to be Nymeria's pack, right? Is maybe Arya?
I think so.
Arya warging into it there? I mean, so I know you'll have to talk about this later. Maybe you can edit it. I don't know how you want to do it. But and then I did like that Jaime can get a little bit of closure from hearing of and actually seeing Vargo Hoat's fate. He may not get all that much satisfaction from it. It doesn't seem like it, but at least he gets some closure, which is nice. And then the last couple of things were just seeing the bear pit was really nice. It was a cool little touch there. Gives us, you know, flashback to one of his best scenes in all the books ever. And it's sweet that he stands up for Brienne at the end. That's about all I say, which I'm sure.
Very much,
Okay, that's about all I had to say. I'll stick around for about 2 more minutes and then I got
to
run.
Okay, so going back to, do we want to talk more about the Cersei stuff or should we move to the middle section of the chapter?
I think we can move to the middle.
I mean, I quite like the road trip. I feel what David was saying about it being, we've seen the ravages of war before, but it's through his eyes. So I like two things about it. First, that it is a little bit mirroring some of Brienne, and it's kind of like before they made a journey together and now we're seeing them maybe retrace some of their footsteps. I love the fact that he thinks of that. It's just very beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, just the insight, you know, he just knows the mountain so well. He has a different take on what different types of nefarious characters might be doing. So I kind of like to see a little bit through his eyes, but I get that we have a lot of people on road trips in this book, so I can kind of feel the frustration. Mm-hmm. Xander, how did you feel about it as the summarizer of the chapter?
I do like that part. Like, to me, it didn't feel as tedious as like maybe David thought it was, specifically because, you know, he's essentially taking the same road that he took back to King's Landing. He's just going back up north. And everything is different. So the first time he was through here, the ravages of war hadn't quite hit as hard because everything was still kind of a little nice in the land. But him retreading these steps and then you getting that like, oh, you know, last time I was here, there was a pond there and there's some, you know, crops there, but now it's just a dried up mud pit and now there's no crop, you know, it really goes to show just how much the war is still going on, even if it's officially over, kind of, you know.
Yeah, it may
the
be
King's
winding
peace
down.
Hasn't returned.
Yeah, exactly. It might be winding down in Cersei's eyes, but people are still living with this. And when a harvest isn't planted and there are weeds up to man height, it's going to take years to get the land back in order. It was sad to read it, actually. I actually found myself being quite affected by it. I don't know why.
No, yeah. I agree. Especially when he gets to, where was it? It was Sir Roger... So Roger something, when they got to his, you know, tower, and he's talking to him, and like, you know, there's wolves and there's lions, and then there's actual wolves, and like, you know, it is really tragic, and it really does kind of bring you more back to the ugliness of what is going on.
Yeah, I would say, and building on that, maybe that the ugliness is being, I don't know, he's obviously, Jamie is on this, it's like almost peacekeeping mission where he's trying to make peace more or less with the Manderleys. That's, I mean, his whole quest here is to kind of release the Manderley son. I'm forgetting his name just now, but, and that's his whole deal. And we have all of Sir Gregor's old men that are also just, I think they're a reflection of the land, or maybe the kinds of people who have destroyed it. This is them, right? This is who's responsible ultimately. And as he's going, I also wanted to mention that when he picks up Ilan Payne, Ilan Payne has not fared well after losing his tongue. He apparently is living in kind of like a shithole. I mean, of the prisoners who are meant to be kept in more comfort, apparently, and his rushes are filled are covered in vermin and all this other stuff. And when Jamie asks him, overflowing chamber pots and a lot of wine bottles. And as Jamie asks him, you know, if you can bear to give all this up, we can come with us. And he's about to leave, and Ilan finally like nods. He's like, yeah. So I think Ilan is probably benefiting some by getting out of King's Landing as well.
I agree with that. That was actually one of the harder things to leave out, because when they're writing and Jamie's thinking about, you know, when he went to go see him and ask him if he wanted to come, he even thinks, he's like, I gave him a choice and he chose this, you know, like, I gave the man a choice that he probably doesn't get very often, and he chose something that possibly would make his situation better.
Yeah, hopefully someone can just come down and like burn down that hut that he's for. I'm not the hut, but wherever he's living is just terrible. But this is what happens. I guess he couldn't read or write, so yeah.
I was thinking this when I listened to the latest episode that's out, 68, I think it is, and it's the one with Nimble Dick Crab. They're talking about how boring it is to hear all this exposition about the small folk and stuff. And we're kind of discussing along those same lines here. And the thought occurred to me when I was listening to their episode was, do you think that George wrote it that way intentionally and forced us into the position of all these people that we read about where, oh fuck, just like, let's move on. We only care about them, the noble people, the game players, and not the fallout. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think I get what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, kind of like, they only care about themselves, and like, then we're kind of like thrust into that position where we're also like, just move on, that's enough. But it's really important to see.
It is. So, like, are you saying, like, even George himself kind of got weary of, like, the small folk perspective?
I'm saying, like, do you think he intended for us to feel like that? For us to feel weary of it, where we only care about the players, we only care about the high games and not the devastation is wreaking behind them, you know.
If we're talking about like trickle down kind of deal, yeah, this is an example. I mean, everything that happens in this land politically is done through these highborn people. Like, there's really nothing that happens small folk wise that impacts the whether or not the country is at war, you know. So that's why I think we find the small folk troubles maybe curious, but not necessarily relevant, only insofar as they affect our main characters, our highborns.
Right. Because, yeah, you know, we do get, like, move on, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, the only times that we really get small folk perspective in writing is in epilogues or in prologues, so, and right, those don't tend to go well. And maybe that is a statement on, you know, I'm sure it is a statement on what happens.
You have this urge where you just want to gloss over it and kind of sweep it under the rug. And I just wonder if that was maybe his intent, you know, a demonstration of how
interesting.
We can sit here all day and judge these people for their actions, and yet we kind of are the same narcissists as them. Like, we only want to hear about them too.
I'm gonna have to chew on that. That's really good.
Yeah, I have no idea if that's his intention, but now that you mention it, that it has that effect, so it could very well be. So.
Okay, so thoughts on the final section at Harrenhal. I mean, just this awful pitting sight of people falling at Jaime's feet, sobbing, being fed on Vargo Hote. It's just
roasted
goat
show.
George does horror writing really well, and I always thought his depiction of the twins and the Frey castle was horrific in the Boltons, but there's something about this horrific, horrifying castle with kind of elements of Elizabeth Bathory, you know, this history of a person dying, you know, bathing in blood, and then the worst of the worst, the hardened scum that would ride with Gregor Clegane rattling around, just... Oh, it was really hard to read.
And I think too, what's super interesting, which caught me on this reread or my read of this chapter, we've been inside Harrenhal through multiple POVs different times, but this time that we're in Harrenhal, almost it almost feels like the tales we've been hearing about Harrenhal this whole series. You know, something's different and uncomfortable about the place this time around.
For sure. It's a qualitative difference, right? It feels eerie and menacing.
I like the word eerie there. Yeah, it feels eerie that is it cursed? Yeah, very well could be. I mean, if we're thinking blood sacrifice has any sort of actual impact, there's been a lot at Harrenhal over the years, right? So if any place has a right to be cursed, it's Harrenhal. Might explain why Littlefinger never wants to set foot on it, it seems.
I mean, anyone in their right mind shouldn't. I mean, whoever takes over finally is sitting on the Iron Throne should just raise it to get a dragon to raise it to the ground. It's never brought happiness to anybody. But yeah, this was horrible.
Well, they tried raising it to the ground, right? They tried doing it.
Yeah, that's true.
They burned down the castle.
Well, now it's half done. So... You know, they should be able to do the other half.
Maybe Danny will. Encore.
Exactly. Targs to the
Even if
win.
It were, like, empty, it's got to be a feeling of, like, if you visit a concentration camp, just knowing all the shitty, horrific things that have happened there. You know what I mean? That
Excellent
would
comparison.
Be spooky.
Yeah.
You know,
but
there's no way that negative energy can't have like an echo through time, you know.
It seems to, or just impact the people in such a way that they are then, you know, a monkey see, monkey do kind of thing, where now the people are starting to be hardened and despicable as they have been taught to be. Or the only ones who survived had to see all of that. So now they have that maybe hardened to it. And they're, you know, it's like, If you see terrible images all the time, and you start to become callous to them, so you don't start realizing how terrible that looks from the outside. And in our modern perspective, that it's tough. Although I do like that we have what is Jaime kind of half fancy himself? I forgot. It was Golden Hand the Just. Is that right? And not necessarily, but. Is that what he says? So,
No, that's actually something I was going to bring up too. Yeah, he does say Golden Hand the Just.
Yeah, so there he is. He slaps someone for talking shit about Brienne, which is good on him. I mean, someone's got to do it, right? But
I love that. It reminds me of like glove slapping someone, you know, like for a duel with like solid gold. In my mind, he backhands it too.
Yes.
It always makes me giggle. I just want every chapter to have him slapping someone with that fucking hand. It's great.
And then, not to get into the show, but he does have, there is a scene, right, where Nikolai Coster-Waldau does, I think it is a backhand, in fact, someone on the Frey Siege of Riverrun, but yeah, different, similar.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, so for sure, that Lannister, I have conspiracy theories about.
I
think somebody's got him somewhere.
He's just dead, right? I mean, like, he fell into the water with his horse, and that was that. No?
No. I do think it was. I'm with Jaime and think it was Varys, because they found his horse, his palfrey, but they didn't find the body. One of the things is they were saying in this chapter is, like, you know, maybe the small folk threw the body into the river, realizing who it was and fearing Tywin's wrath. But I think I think it is Varys kind of utilizing it, you know, maybe when Daenerys or Aegon come over to Westeros as like, oh, here, I have a Lannister for you.
Perfect. I'm wondering, I haven't gone back and read that in a while, but did Varys come down to the docks with them to see Myrcella off the day of the rites? Because that's when we lost Tyrek.
Oh, that's a good question.
So if he's around, then it might not be him. I mean, he has his little birds or whatever. But if he is not around, I think that there's a lot of credence to that.
I've always thought it might have been someone with the Iron Bank, maybe, too. Like, I think that the crown owes a lot of... Yeah, I think that they owe a lot of money, and he might have been taken as an insurance policy to retain Casterly Rock for a purpose, you know.
Oh, interesting. So you're saying that if something happens to, like, the main Lannister people, then they can put him in charge and say, pay us back.
Right. I honestly think that there's got to be something there. I don't have any solid ideas, but George brings it up frequently. And I don't see him going out of his way to sprinkle those little nuggets in for no reason. So I think he's alive. I think he's being held by someone for some purpose. I'm not certain exactly what it is, but I think it has to do with Casterly Rock and money.
Oh, you know what? I'd like to see Jaime just be outright right about this, because so many times when someone has a theory, I'm talking about the in-book characters have a theory about what happened to what, we can almost automatically discount it. But as Jaime is kind of seen as the stupidest Lannister, I'd like for all his theories just to be right. he's just right. He's very intuitive and just right about everything.
Right, yeah. I mean, like when he was saying that, I was like, actually, that's a really good perceptive comment. And we see it later with the Blackwoods and all the, you know, negotiating aspects. He's not stupid, Jaime.
No, I would agree. He's very intuitive and understanding of situations. You know, even earlier in this chapter when they started traveling, he had the Outriders go out because he even made the comment like, Robb Stark caught me in the Whispering Woods. I don't expect to do it again, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that they even mentioned earlier in the novel, George mentioned earlier that Jaime had problems with dyslexia or something, that words would get, or the letters would get jumbled in his head. So although he may not be book learning smart, maybe he does learn from experience. As we see, he seems to have rebounded from his lost hand in a more positive way than I expect Cersei will rebound, if that's indeed what happens, from her social shaming,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, public shaming. So we'll just see. I think it'd be really cool to see the Lannister children having basically be three split parts of the Tywin-esque character.
Yes.
Where we've got Cersei, who schemes but isn't good at it, and Jaime, who is intuitive but cannot put the things together in order to make schemes happen and is more or less just reactionary. And then Tyrion, who has inherited maybe his father's spite and anger. I don't know, but... I don't know.
And his sexual appetites were whores, apparently.
Oh my god, apparently.
Yeah, he knew. I think Jaime maybe just falls into that category of people who have a learning problem or disability that, mm-hmm. you know, they're told by people they're not good at reading and writing, and they kind of take it on board as a perception of themselves that they're not smart because people tell them that, especially in this time period, right, where there's no understanding of dyslexia or dyspraxia or anything.
Right.
And then, but actually he is smart, so he goes into the sword fighting, and that's very easy for him, so he kind of spends all his time and effort training on that. And one of the things I love about this chapter as well is you see his discipline. Like, you see that you don't just become a great swordsmith overnight, that he would have put that practice in originally, and what physical and mental courage to do it now again with your just left hand and being willing to put in those hours overnight. And yet he probably did have that ability if he could have thrown that discipline at the book learning, but he was always made to feel that he was stupid at it because he couldn't distinguish the letters probably, which is not his fault, and then he's internalized that. But he's probably kind of smarter than we all think he is at this point. I don't think it's just intuitive. I mean, there's some of his reasoning here where I think this is exactly how Terry needs to figure stuff out when he was Hand of the King, and we would admire it. And he has that, you know, and I really hope to see that explored and taken further. That would give me so much joy.
Yeah, we have his main crux of his interests removed from him. And even though he wants, because he is known in the land as being the greatest swordsman or whatever, he needs to at least uphold that somewhat competence. So that's why he's trying. And I think he also does miss his ability. He misses it, right? But But we'll see if now that it's been removed from him, if he can still pivot. He's got gray hairs in his beard, so we'll just see. But yeah.
I love
it. Well, I mean, like, he makes a comment at one point about fearing, like, that's why he explains his bruises away the way he does. Like, being afraid if people found out that he was no good anymore.
Yeah, because they could mock him for it. Like, don't be stupid. You'll never be as good. This is just a fool's errand. And I wonder, even though Ellen Payne does laugh at him at one point, which is really horrifying, that kind of hacking silent laugh.
Oh, my gosh,
I think I at least admire Ellen Payne for doing the training with him. And also, maybe that contributed to his reason for going with Jamie. I mean, you know, they've known each other.
He can't talk.
Maybe there's a bit of mutual respect there, you know.
Well, I think, like, I don't know if Jamie like outright says it, but I got the sense that he was afraid that people would just start challenging him willy-nilly left and right, and he would die if they found out that
I thought it was more just a sort of like that they would mock him for even trying rather than challenging him.
Yeah,
See how he can get around the fact that people are just going to know, okay, you're not going to be as good left-handed. This kind of goes without saying. I don't know how pervasive that feeling might be, because being that the small folk mostly don't read or write at all, that they wouldn't necessarily know if the people have dominant hands. I don't know, because that's generally
catch nights, you know, like I would never take a run at him before, but now maybe I will, you know. Yeah, I feel like there's some self-preservation aspects of it too. I just want to say though about him being dyslexic, when I read that I was like, oh, my homeboy, because I'm severely dyslexic, so
same.
That really like was a little nugget of cool, like,
yeah.
Pretty much just going back to Jamie and his growth, and Ty, you brought this up earlier with like him calling himself Golden Hand the Just, is the idea about him being called Golden Hand comes up, I think, 2 or 3 times in this chapter. I forgot to mark it down, but the first couple of times it's you know, brought up to Jamie, he thinks, no, they'll just think of me as the Kingslayer, you know, my entire life until I die, I'm the Kingslayer. But then, yeah, at the end of the, or near the end of the chapter, he thinks he'll be known as Golden Hand the Just. And I just wanted to use that as like a nice, pretty much just what this entire chapter slash his whole arc is just him going from, yeah, I'll just be the Kingslayer to, you know what, maybe they will call me Golden Hand the Just.
Yeah, that's another beautiful sentiment. I love how this podcast is ending. This is glorious. God bless you, Jamie.
Keep it up, Jamie.
I hope it works. If George screws up that beautiful redemption arc, I'm not going to forgive him.
That makes us worry. I get worried about it because it's like he wants to subvert all the tropes, and he's clearly put Jamie on this path. And I'm like, don't do it. Yeah. Don't do it, George.
Just please let us have this one.
The one thing to make me quit A Song of Ice and Fire is if he goes, I'm done.
I'm out. Oh. I agree. The Red
I
Wedding
can just hear
it.
Sarah Lady Weaver like screaming at us right now. Like, don't even say that.
Okay, we'll end it there. We don't want to traumatize our listeners.
She's such a Jamie fan club leader. Like,
absolutely.
Right. How dare you even say it?
Okie dokie. So for those following along at home, the next episode of Reread I think might be hosted by Marina Miria, but I'm not sure yet. If any of you would like to host, edit, and you know, be part of the Reread hosting community, let me know. That would be great. It's going to cover Elaine 1, the first Elaine chapter, which is released answer 2, Brienne 4 from Feast, and Bran 3 from Dance. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress, all by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave. But if you want to get involved, discuss the chapters, be on a podcast, then join the forums of A Podcast of Ice and Fire. Do any of you have, I mean, bear in mind this won't be out for 8 weeks, but are there any kind of long-term projects, podcasts you want to pimp out, or does the issuing timeline make that silly?
Well, I think that we are, by the time this is out, Sense8's finale will be out, and I don't know if we're going to record it, but I think we are going to try to do like a group watch.
Oh, lovely. Okay.
Together, and we'll definitely be doing at least a solid discussion on that to wrap that up. So.
Oh, I look forward to that. And that's really good.
Yeah, and tentatively, Hannah and I are moving forward with the Zodiac podcast. There are
wonderful.
There are some developments in the case. Some DNA evidence has been sent out.
Oh, really?
And I think we'll wait and see kind of where this goes and if there's more to be learned. I'm also doing some research on this, so that way I'm trying to bulk up some of my background on the Zodiacular. And also I'm aware of the hesitancies and we want to address these, you know, this carefully as well. So there's going to be some work that I'm going to do on that as well.
Cool. Well, no, I think it's a great podcast to do. We've been umming and ahhing. I'm really excited you're taking it on. And, you know, I think with those serial killer podcasts, like everyone in this community always just tries to do them sensitively. You'll do the same and it'll be great. And I think it's going to be fascinating to listen to. I look forward to it. I think SJ Lee and Mikhail Inkazrain are going to do a Handmaid's Tale maybe mid-season and then wrap up, so I think that'll still be just about running when this comes out. So if anyone's interested in joining that, they should hop on the forums, and the Westworld Juggernaut rumbles on too in the meantime. Nice.
Yeah, and Bina, do we have any information on when the Mindhunter podcast will be out, because I have been itching to listen to that. As
please feel free to lobby Matt Varley. I mean, I think that this guy talks so much smack about getting this podcast recorded like for like decades, and then we recorded it, and then it was like he is now really procrastinating about editing it. So there's a running joke about will T-Wow or the Mindhunt podcast be out first.
I literally too, like, I don't know if I had a dream or what, but I went crazy and Ty was asking me about it. I was like, it is out.
And I was like, really? Like, where?
And I was like, yeah, I just don't think he put the link in the forum, but it's on WordPress. And David's like, no, it's not. And I'm going, then what the hell did I listen to? Because I swear
he was dreaming about
the podcast. I swear I listened to this podcast.
I mean, what I could do, Ty, is send you, like, I actually did the backup recording, so I can send you the files. You can listen to what we chatted about. It wasn't that long.
That's all right.
But that it's going to fall. And the thing is, he keeps guilting me into, like, wanting to edit. And I could easily edit it. It would take me, like, a couple of hours. But I'm trying to reinforce the point that he needs to commit
you
to.
You hosted it. Okay.
I'm being hard on him because he's, like, a genuine friend. Like, I hang out with him and I just feel like, come on, Matt. I know how much time you spend in your hammock. I know how much time you spend pottering around your house doing fuck all, because you tell me on a daily basis, get this shit done.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so with that, I'll say thank you very much to David, who had to leave early to go to work, to my lovely hosts, Sander and Hannah, and to Ty. It was a pleasure meeting you by the means of Skype. thank you for joining.
Yes, you as well.
These were cool chapters. It was really fun discussing them with you all. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you again, Bina.
Okay.
Bye. Yeah, thanks, Bina. Bye.
I mean, that's kind of what I thought. I was like, there's no way. And then I think that's when I realized that feast and dance were the same, kind of. Like, I didn't get that right away when I was reading it. So I think I started, like, read ahead and go, no fucking way. And then it kind of clicked, like, oh, okay.
When you read Feast, you didn't realize it was only half the story?
No, that's why I kept going, like, where the fuck are all these people? Like,
no way.
How long is this? Like, how are we gonna, when are we get
that
these
guys?
That is
hilarious. You were, like, sitting there going, like, where the fuck is Danny?
Yeah.
No.
I don't think I read the show in the beginning, or if I did, I don't get it. Like, yeah. I know, but I don't think I read it, or I didn't, like, really understand what he was saying.
That's
hilarious. Like, I didn't get that, like, some people wouldn't be in it at all. Like, I wasn't getting that.
God bless you, Hannah. That's brilliant.
No, I did the same thing, because I think in my edition, the note on the chronology was at the end of the book.
Oh, that's cruel. That's cruel. Why would you put it at the end?
Yeah. In mine, too. That's what it is. Yeah.
No,
so
mine's up front.
It, like...
Mine's at the front, so I knew.
Yeah, that's right. We must have the same. It's the paperback one, right, that you have, Xander?
That is so stupid. That's so mean to anyone who doesn't know what's going on.
Right.
Like, oh, when this book's blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, Okay. That's why everyone's like, well, I read them together. I'm like, no, didn't realize that was a do.
I didn't. My first time I read them straight through. So, but,
so the first time I read it, Dance wasn't out yet. So it was that thuddering.
Yeah,
disappointment.
I still had to wait for Dance too.
Yeah. Of like opening, like the excitement of getting this new book and then thinking, oh shit, like characters I really care about are not in this book.
I think Dance like just come out when I picked
So how do you guys feel? Because on his, not a blog, he's been answering some questions.
Mm-hmm.
And George has said two things. First of all, he's not simultaneously writing Winds and Dream.
Yep,
so for people who were using that as an excuse for it not coming out, that's definitely not happening. Nope. And then the other thing he said is that apparently the publishers have suggested he split up Winds into two books and he's resisting.
Right.
How would you feel if you got Winds and it wasn't chronologically split but character split again?
Ooh,
or do you think he would do that after the reception that Dance had?
No, I don't think so, given that it was such a mess. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I don't think he would do that, but if he released anything Winds, I'd devour it.
Exactly.
Yeah, of course.
Would not be mad.
I mean, a part of me wishes he would just like release like a chapter a week forever and we could just pay for it now and I'll get each chapter as we go.
Like a Charles Dickens serial in the old days. Yeah, I mean, like,
I did say there wouldn't be any more recently at all.
Yeah, same.
I think though, if it's so big and he's having so much trouble with it and they're encouraging him to split it up, that's totally fine because they had encouraged him years ago to make it 8.
True.
Because
I don't feel like
he said 7 books were 7 kingdoms and then they pointed out to him that it was really 8.
I mean, they would love it, right? Because it's more money. There's more books.
Well, exactly. So. And I don't feel like they're doing this because they want him to. I don't think it's just because it's too long. I think it's more a matter of, hey, let's get a book out already before the show's over, before we run out of, you know, the biggest interest we have, our biggest free advertising. Let's get something out because we'll make millions on it.
Yeah, of course, the best time to release the book will be as the season 7 ends, or season 8 ends.
Right.
Announce it's coming out just as HBO is really hyping up the advertising for the final season,
yep.
And release it the day after the final episode is done. Boom. Right.
There's plenty of advertising there. They're doing the spinoffs. That's never going away.
I know, but that's the biggest. This is the moment, though. If you could get out a book, if you put out a book right with any time during the last season, it would probably, you know, 30% more sales than it would be a year. Once it's over,
totally
I don't
agree.
Think it's been,